A smart person learns from their mistakes. A wise person learns from others' mistakes. Welcome to the My Mistakes Podcast. We cover the lessons learned from the mistakes we've made in business so you won't do the same. I'm Chris Chantrulli. Today's guest is considered by many to be the most well-known Howard Stern intern of all time. I speak of Steve Grillo. If Howard Stern is the king of all media, Steve Grillo was his jester. Find out some of the crazy antics and things that went on behind the scenes and learn how Steve went from preparing the perfect potato to now podcasting. This episode is being brought to you by Don Pablo Coffee. Specialty grade beans roasted in small batches. It's a better cup of coffee. Get yours at Amazon or at donpablocoffee.com. Okay, so today on the My Mistakes podcast and continuing with my Howard Stern-centered interviews, I guess people have joked to me, we have someone who was really a staple to the show back in the days when Howard was very different than he is now, and I'm very happy to welcome Mr. Steve Grillo.
What's up, homie?
Thank you for taking the time to do this. I recently stumbled upon your podcast, and that was the first thing I wanted to ask you about. How did you get involved in doing that, and how do you have such an incredible studio, and where is that located?
Well, right now it's on lockdown, obviously, like everything else is. So, but it is located 50th Street. It's called Pro Media. I got a really cool family around here in Hell's Kitchen, and the bars are getting shut down left and right. So now it seems like my apartment has become a new pub. So my boys are here just staying off the street, trying to be COVID-free kind of thing. So I opened my door to all my friends to come up here, use the bathroom, have a drink. I have a really nice roof. Not that, believe me, I'm in big trouble financially right now with this whole shit, but I do have a roof deck overlooking Times Square, so everybody likes to come over here. Instead of being on the street, it's a nice place to social distance and have a nice view. So people come down here, and they make a cocktail, they go back upstairs. You know, they're kind of helping out all my friends who become my family over this weird time that we're going through. So anyway, Pro Media is not too far from my apartment. The people over there, Joe D'Imperio, offered to help me out. He believed in what I was doing and gave me his studio for practically nothing, which means nothing, and lent me his engineers. And I started doing my podcast, and it's been almost 2 years, and it's just grown exponentially. I'm very proud of the people that have helped me along the way. They're amazing people, and I love them all. And just every week, it's a new story, and it gets bigger and bigger.
And what are you doing for work now? You said financially trouble. What are you doing for work now, and is the podcast paying?
I was making money. I was with another network, and they weren't paying me, but I was getting my sponsorships on my own, people that were advertising with me, and I was doing really well last year. And it's not a falling out. It was just sort of like a matter of parting, a very like amicable parting of ways with the Battle Chats network. And I just really wanted to do my own thing and had my own direction. And we shook hands and we sort of separated. They still playing my old, if you go to Battle Chats, you can check out some of my older shows that I did at Pro Media. So COVID happened and I just started developing the network, and StreamYard makes things a lot easier. I have my executive producer, Noah, who's directing everything and handling all the content. So I have another show on my Aftershock XL network. It's Coffee and Conspiracy Theories with Jesse Nash, who is a renowned journalist, and my friend comedian Stacey Prussman, who has Prussman on Fire, where she just basically comes on and talks about whatever she's thinking. She's very funny. I did Grandma Sylvia's with her years ago. And you know, and now I got, it's Elegante's World, which anybody knows the Stern show. Well, you can't call her Elliot anymore, but Elegant Elliot Offen, who was a staple on the Stern show for years, I'm developing a show with her. So right now we're auditioning a co-host for her show on the network. And she's very much herself. If anybody remembers her, you know what you're expecting. And it's very entertaining.
I haven't watched her in a long time. Is she transgender now, or is she still just a crossdresser?
I thought it would be fun to have like a jingle for her, you know, opening. Like, you know, I was thinking kind of something cheesy, kind of like from the 1950s, like, din, 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 it's Elegant's World. So it's going to be like, he's a he, but don't call her a he. It's Elegant's World. So we're coming up with little jingles and stuff like that creatively to have an opening for the show. But yeah, Michelle Agante is quite the character. There's nothing fake about what's going on there. She is identifying as a woman. Her name is Miss Elegante or Miss Elegant. Do not call her Elliot. Do not do anything otherwise because she will put you in your place. And everybody knows that she's verbose and has quite the vocabulary. And she will make you look very bad.
So you started doing the podcast. And then with COVID happening, what are you doing now for work and how's that going?
When I was making money off, you know, when I was on Battle Chats with my sponsors, it was nice. It was like some nice money. It wasn't like I was like swimming in it, but I was paying my rent, doing my shit. So I also picked up a job doing beer and liquor sales, which provided me with healthcare, which I didn't have for a really long time. And it was sort of like a couple extra bucks in my pocket doing what I do best. I know the bar business in and out, and it's in my old neighborhood. So I know a lot of people down there, and it was just, it was fun. But now after all this shit happened, I became an essential worker. I still have my health insurance and I'm doing that on a day-to-day basis. It's just, it gets me off the couch. I walk about 5 to 7 miles a day, my fat ass needs. And I just, you know, if I get sick, I'm covered.
Especially at a time like this, that's definitely a good thing. Where'd you grow up? Where are you from originally?
Canarsie, Brooklyn. Yeah, so I'm a Brooklyn boy that just fell in love with Manhattan and got out as soon as I possibly could. I grew up in the middle of Goodfellas, bro. I wasn't living there at the time, but the actual Bamboo Lounge, I can see from my bedroom window. I didn't know that it was that at the time. But the Bamboo Lounge was on Rockaway Parkway and Avenue N. I could see Rockaway Parkway and Avenue N from my bedroom window. Paul Sorvino's character in Goodfellas was, in real life, was Paul Vario. I went to 8 years of grammar school with Dana Vario. So I grew up in Mob Central, and I hated every minute of it. I couldn't stand any of them. I begged my parents to move on a weekly basis, but we stayed there. And the moment I can get out, I did. So.
And then when you got out, how did you end up leaving there and then ending up on the Stern Show? That was an internship, right? Originally?
It was a weird moment in my life where I was in seventh grade and my mother, you know, I was going into high school and I went to Catholic school. And my mother said, well, me and your father, we want to put decision on you. Do you want to go to public high school? Or if you want to go to Catholic high school, we'll pay for it. But give us a reason. And I said, Mom, first of all my friends went to public high school. They never went. They were all smart. They all skipped the grade. They never went to class because they were really smart. I knew if I didn't go force myself to get an education, I'd be real stupid. So I knew that, but I gave my mother a really good answer. I said, Mom, I said, I want to go to Nazareth because when I go to get a job, I think on my resume, Nazareth Regional High School would look much better than Canarsie High School. And she goes, Stephen, that's the best answer you could ever give me. You want to go to Nazareth? You're going to Nazareth. So I went to Nazareth and I wrestled. And that was my life for 4 years. And wrestling got me into Hunter College. And one day I was at Hunter College listening to the Stern Show. And I had no way, I didn't realize that they were at 600 Madison Avenue. And I was like, 600 Madison Avenue, that's like not far. Because Hunter's on 68th and Lexington. So I literally got up, skipped class, walked down Madison Avenue, walked into 600 Madison, up to the fourth floor, and there I am standing in the K-Rock lobby, and there's the door. And I'm like, and there was this ugly green plastic plant on the other side of the door. And I said, I don't care what it takes. I'm going to get past that plastic fucking plant. And I did. I just didn't give up.
Well, how did you end up on the show? Who did you interview with? What was the job description?
First, I sent a resume, a professional resume. Like, my aunt was a secretary and shit. Like, she did it upright. And I dropped it off, and I didn't hear anything. And that was the end of my freshman semester, right, going into the summer. So I didn't hear anything. I'm like, so September comes, and I just can't get it out of my head. So instead of sending, like, I already sent the professional resume out, let me go the 180 and do something completely different. I handwrote a letter to Gary, skipped every other line, I went for the pathetic angle. Like, I'm just going to be pathetic. I ripped it out of my spiral notebook. I stuffed it into an envelope and I dropped it off at K-Rock. And the next day I got a phone call. My sister took it. She comes out. I never forget. I just walked in the door and my sister goes, some guy like called, like his name was like Gary. I don't know what he wanted. I was like, did you take a number? She's like, no. I was like, you didn't take Gary who? Gary who? And I'm like shaking her, and my mother grabbed me by the back of the hair, and she's like, get the fuck off your sister. It was Gary Delabate. I interviewed him with him, And we talked about wrestling, because he used to wrestle, which is a great angle. But I lived in Brooklyn, and this other girl that I was up against lived in Manhattan. So Gary called me up and goes, I would normally have taken you, but it's been my experience that it's really hard to get here at 5 o'clock in the morning, and she lives in Manhattan and you live in Brooklyn, and I really can't chance you not showing up. So I'm going to go with her. But what I will tell you is, call me back right after Thanksgiving. I have a project I think you might be perfect for working on. And I came back, and it was basically a bunch of tapes that weren't logged on the show. Basically tapes that, like, they had no idea what was going on. And they basically showed me how to write descriptions and what they were talking about at what time. And I had a box of tapes, and I came every day at 5 o'clock. Didn't have to. I could have done this anytime. But I showed up every day at 5 o'clock, and I sat in the back, watched and listened to those tapes and logged those tapes in, and showed up every goddamn day. My mistake was I could have probably milked it for a really long time, but I didn't. I ran through that box because I was there every day at 5 o'clock until like 12.
What year is this?
1991. So I was 19 years old. People took notice. They couldn't put me on there, but Gary's like, the promotions department took notice, and they had me on. And most interns like did 2 days, couple hours. You know, there was events. Maybe they went and they picked and choose what event they wanted. I did 5 days, and I went to every event, no matter what it was. Fucking giving out flyers and bumper stickers at a Grateful Dead concert, going to this concert, handing out flyers, going to the St. Patrick's Day, like with the K-Rock band. I did everything. I was there. You couldn't keep me out of that. I was like so insanely obsessed with being there. So I went from the Stern Show to promotions. Obviously, that they took notice. They're like, this kid's insane. Like, he's nice. He does everything. He's polite. He's eager. It doesn't bother anybody. So finally, Robin had enough of her intern. Everybody was pushing me for that job. And Robin said, cool. And that's when I started. I was Robin's news intern.
What was more important to you at that age, around 19, 20 years old? Was it being involved with the Stern Show, or was it the idea of working at a radio station doing promotions or anything?
I had no interest in radio whatsoever. You know, Howard's like whole story is like, oh, my dad was a radio engineer and I wanted to be in radio. I didn't give a fuck. All I know is that I knew that show was the best thing I've ever heard in my entire life, and that I needed to be there. That's it. I had to be there. And whether I didn't care if I was in promotions. You wonder why? Promotions, 20 feet down the hall was the Howard Stern Show. And they all knew me, and they all liked me. Yeah, here's another funny story. Well, the first time I saw Howard, you know how Joey Ramone and Howard looked the same?
Yeah.
Okay, well, my friend Shari Bernstein, her brother Neil, is another Howard doppelganger. So I grew up with Neil. So the first time I saw Howard, I was like, that's fucking Neil Bernstein. I'm like, that's Neil Bernstein. Like I wasn't like, oh my God, that's Howard Stern. Like, I saw Howard on TV, but the presence, the long curly hair, the blue eyes, the big nose, tall and skinny, that was Neil Bernstein, it was Joey Ramone, it was Howard Stern. They all look exactly the same. So that was my first impression of him physically when I met him. That's why I was like, oh, that's Neil. Neil's a goofball. You know, like,
do they do like an introduction like, Howard, this is Steven, he's one of the interns?
When I was logging tapes, it was me and Sandy Kirkman, we're still friends. She was basically, unfortunately, had the task of reading my handwriting and entering it into the computer because I used to do it on paper. So Sandy was basically, I'd hand off Sandy the login information, and then she'd input it into the computer. And it was just me and Sandy, and it was just basically like Gary going, oh, these are our two new interns. And he couldn't have been any nicer, bro. He was just like, hey, guys, thanks for being a part of the team. I heard you guys are doing really good work. Thank you so much. But that's Howard off the air. You know what I'm saying? Which is something my father would never understand. You know, off the air, he was kind, gregarious. He was polite. Thank you, please, all this other shit. Because he was brought up the right way, you know, but he just developed this personality that became, like, legendary.
Were you surprised when you met him that he was so different than what you'd heard on air?
All I could think about is, oh, my God, he's fucking Neil Bernstein.
So you then start with Robin as her intern, and then how does that work with her?
That first day is a legendary story because Gary was supposed to tell the girl not to show back up on Monday. Well, he forgot. So I'm in one room trying to learn. Ganji's trying to teach me what I'm supposed to do to give her the news. And she comes in, slams the door, and she goes, what the fuck is she doing here? She's not supposed to be here. This is fucking embarrassing. Gary forgot to fire the girl. So she comes in the room screaming at the top of her head. I'm like, oh man, do I have to work for this woman? But she never, ever screamed at me. She's never been nothing but such a wonderful, amazing human being to me. We became really, really close friends. She would take me to the theater. She would take me to the movies. She would take me to dinner. She'd take me to lunch. We'd go and watch movies at her house. She became like one of my best friends.
While you were her intern, and did that end up?
Even after that, not so much now because it's just shit's weird over there now and I get it, but it's just, you know, this happenstance, circumstance, whatever you want to call it. It just, unfortunately, I lost touch with her and we'll just leave it at that, but that does not mean that I don't love her with all my heart.
How did you keep making your way or progressing more and more onto camera, on air?
Because I never thought I was going to be in the entertainment business. I had no idea what the hell was going on. I just knew that when I went to college and I was wrestling, everybody in the wrestling team was taking physical therapy. And I just sort of like almost like blindly followed the sheep. And I was like, wait a minute, I'm in college. The fuck? This is the time when you're supposed to explore and learn. So I started taking up communications and I started taking communication courses and this and that. And then that old Howard thing happened at the same time. So I started exploring that, but I never, like an actor. No, I thought myself more as like a producer and a writer. My minor was theater, and I took an acting class, and I'm like, these people are fucking pathetic. You know, I was like, oh my God. He's like, because the people in the acting classes were like really trying to be actors. And I'm just more of a bullshit artist, which means I'm an actor, but I didn't know it. So I got a role in Grandma Sylvia's Funeral, which is an off-Broadway play, which I didn't realize that off-Broadway was actually something that was extremely credible. And I got the part because I was really good at improv. That was a huge part of the role. And they wanted me because I worked on the Howard Stern Show. Don't get me wrong. But I never acted a day in my life. But because I had strong improv skills, which means I was a bullshit artist, I got the role. And I just did it because whatever. But, you know, because I was making an extra paycheck. I'm like, cool. And plus, I got laid more from doing an off-Broadway play than I ever did on the Howard Stern Show. I did Grandma Sylvia's and I realized, like, wow, acting's pretty cool. So I started really getting into it. And then I left the show. Grandma Sylvia's ended. I left the show and I was dating my girlfriend, Julie, at the time. She was in Private Parts. We met on the set. I fell in love with the movie and the industry working on Private Parts. I really learned a lot and I still have lifelong friends from that set that I still talk to on a regular basis. It introduced me to a whole new world of movie making and the process of how it happens and whatever. I was very well educated on the set of Private Parts. And I almost quit until I didn't realize I was educated. I was a must hire. And must hires are people that skip. In order to be a PA on set in any movie, you usually have to be in the office for 6 months before you even set foot on a set. I didn't have to do that because Howard gave me the job. I surpassed that, and there was a lot of resentment, especially from the key PA, who was my kind of like off-base direct boss, kind of. He ran the PA as an answer to the second director. So, but he made my life a living hell. And I was just about to quit until one of my best friends goes, so what happens on the movie set? And I was like, oh, so tedious. The electric's got to come in, and then the set dresser's got to come in, and then the props got to come in. And I went on and on and on. And I stopped for a second. I said, yo, I didn't know anything like that 2 weeks ago. I was like, oh, shit, I'm learning. So I really took the abuse and just stood there and became a student and watched all these amazing people and how they got together and worked, and I just absorbed it, and I fell in love with it.
And Howard took care of all of you guys really well as far as getting everyone that was involved in the show, in the movie, in some way or another, correct?
No, he didn't. Stuttering John had to beg. And the only reason why he begged, Stuttering John should have been in the movie. We all should have had some parts. It would have been real easy. It wasn't a big deal to throw everybody in there, like Scott the Engineer and Gary, you know, whatever. John begged so bad that it actually became an issue because that's how we made it into the end of the movie. Yeah, you know, so John screamed so loud that it became funny and they used it at the end. But we all could have, I was SAG at that point. There could have been bones thrown around and there wasn't. So I won't agree on that. I was happy enough to have the job and learn as much as I did, but we'll leave it at that.
What about the infamous Gary Howard's potato?
He was on some weird, like trendy diet or whatever, and he just didn't trust John. And John couldn't get it right or couldn't get it ready when he needed it, and he needed it every day. So it fell on me, and that was it.
Something stood out to me, and I know that Howard was making fun of it, but what I observed at the time, and it stands out to me, is that you took such pride in how you did it, and Howard was like laughing about that. But I remember being a teenager and like respecting that because it was like lessons my dad taught me about anything you do, give it your best. You are really like putting a tremendous effort in.
Well, dude, the king of all media daunts you with a task. Do it right. Plus, also the other thing is, if you didn't do it right, you got made fucking fun of on the air. I didn't want that. So it was my drive was really not to get made fun of. You know what I'm saying? As much as people like went out of their way to try to get on the air, I spent my time trying to stay off the air.
And what was it like going on like in the back office? In the E! Show, you would see you commenting on whatever was going on air. And
the back office was run by the maniacal Stuttering John, who I love to death, who I talked to today for about a half an hour. I talked to him at least once a week. John is an extremely intelligent human being. He is no doubt modern day Tom Sawyer, where he will get you to whitewash his fence and make you think that you owed him that. We were like cats and dogs because John knew how to push my buttons. And I was definitely an angry, angry youth. Like, I'm from Brooklyn, man. You know, you don't come at me because I'm going to come back at you. And John knew that, but he also knew that he loves to argue. And my arguments were never comparable.
Did any physical fights take place back there that fans wouldn't know about?
It's almost the first day that I was there. Because, you know, Howard's desk was if Howard wasn't there, it was John's desk. And, you know, no one ever knew about that. So if John was there, John had to sit behind Howard's desk. And that was that. I got there my first day when I was like, you know, right before that Robin story. It was like 5 o'clock, because, you know, that's the time I was supposed to be there. John was forever late. That's where the phone was, where Ronnie called. John had to go down and pick up Howard. So I was there when I had my, like, sort of like, it was dark. I just had my head down on the desk, like, you know, kind of like dozing, sleeping a little bit. And John comes in and he just stands, like, in a picture of my head down on the desk. He stands like right next to me, as close as he possibly can. He goes, "Get the fuck up." And I was like, "Huh?" He goes, "You heard what I said. Get the fuck up." And I was like, "How about, can you please get up? I need to sit down." He goes, "No, please. I said, get the fuck up." I said, "Well, guess what? I'm not going anyway. This is my first day." And I had already known John, like, from, like, here and there, like, in the hallway and shit. But, like, and I was a fan of John. I love the shit that he did. But, again, I'm from Brooklyn. So it's like, yo, you either talk to me with respect or we're going to have words. So we had words. And we went nose to nose. And I stood up and I was like, "You think you're going to fucking sit here and talk to me like that? We got a fucking problem." He's like, "Who the fuck do you think?" You know, so it was like, basically, I'll give you that chair, but you don't ever fuck, you know. And then it was like, he's like, "Yo, lucky you're a fucking intern. I'd lose my job. I'd fuck you up right now." I was like, "Okay, guess what?" So it was just like one of those, like, you know, male macho things that happened. That was my first day with John.
Wow. And then I remember from old episodes, you renting an apartment and all that. So you guys must have.
Yeah, no, there was another fucking bullshit thing. I'll tell you why. Because you want to know why? You know, the apartment was originally owned, rented from Dennis Blair. Dennis Blair wrote Easy Money. He was one of Ronnie Dangerfield's writers. And Dangerfield's was like 4 or 5 blocks down the road. So obviously that was a crash pad for the comics at Dangerfield's. And it was a 6-floor walk up and a tenement building that had a bathtub in the kitchen, which is my favorite apartment ever. So it went from Dennis Blair to Jackie the Joke Man. And the apartment was $300 a month.
Wow.
And then it went from Dennis Jackie the Joke Man to Stuttering John, $300 a month. Then it came to me and Ganji. So instead of doing the right thing and saying $300 a month, he charged us both $300 a month and kept $300 for himself. So, okay, fine. But somehow or another, you know, the apartment was in John's name or whatever. And somehow they caught on. And John was, it wasn't just like, "Okay, you guys are going to have to move." He was like, "Get your shit out tomorrow." And it's like, "No, it doesn't work like that. Get your shit out tomorrow. I got nowhere to go. Legally, that's not how it goes." And John's like, "But it's my name." I was like, "I don't give a fuck. I ain't going on the street."
Wow. So he'd expect you to just up and leave
tomorrow. I was like, "No."
Wow.
He's like, "You're fucking me, girl. You're fucking me, girl." I'm like, "No, you're fucking me. You've been making a profit off of us for fucking 2 years, like a year and a half." When Jackie didn't make a profit, Dennis Blair didn't make an apartment. Oh, by the way, when we did eventually move out, I found two Easy Money scripts with handwritten notes. It was really cool. I still have one of them.
That's a score. How long did you last on the show? And like, what stands out as kind of some of the things that you learned along the way? Or what did you observe being in the den of the greatest radio show of all time?
Well, you know, like I said earlier, I was never, the radio was never my goal. I never even thought, like, and then once I got involved in the radio, in the entertainment business, basically, radio is the bottom of the barrel of the entertainment industry. And I didn't realize how much I picked up, how much I learned while I was there. Because you spent 8 years working on the Howard Stern Show. That's a better education than if you went to Harvard and learned radio, you know? So it's kind of like almost like I always kid around and say I have a doctorate in radio, you know? 8 years of working with the most greatest radio host ever, ever.
What stands out, like, when you saw Howard operate? I know that you didn't want to go into radio, but what separates him or what stirred out?
And just he didn't give a fuck. He was, like, against, it was just like, you didn't fuck with him. You know what I'm saying? And he surrounded himself with, like, sick bastards. And I'm a sick bastard, so I just felt like I needed to be around those sick bastards.
Was he managing them to, like, produce for him, or did people just fall in line automatically? What kind of manager was he?
He was behind-the-scenes manager no matter what. Like, you're never going to get a straight answer out of him. It's either going to come from Gary or say Kathy Tobin or some office manager or Laura, his assistant. It never came from him. And, what my father never understood was, like, he'd, you know, rip you apart on the air and go, oh, we'll be back right with these words. And then he'd go click and he'd turn and go, that was great, man. Oh my God, that was fucking funny. And I'm like, okay, that was okay, Howard. Like just like an hour of getting my ass ripped apart. And then Howard's like, no, that was fucking awesome. And I'm like, okay, thank you. Can I go now?
Well, wow, it's kind of on and off that fast.
My dad never understood that. My dad had a hard time dealing with that. I told my dad not to listen. I told my dad not to tell his friends that I worked on the show. And what did my dad do? He did exactly that. My dad's a really sensitive, kind person. I have my mother's personality, not my father's. My father's like the old school Italian that sits in the corner, don't bother nobody, don't talk shit about nobody, this and that. And he found it hurtful that this guy was attacking his son. And then his friends at work would turn around and go, oh, Grillo, your fucking son really got it on the air today. And that made it worse.
Yeah.
So that's why I moved out as soon as I possibly could, on top of the fact that I couldn't stand Brooklyn and I love Manhattan. But it was hard on my old man. And I told him and he didn't listen. But I was like, Dad, you don't understand. It's like when he goes to commercial, he's telling me that was great. I don't care. Why do you have to say that? I was like, Dad, because if he didn't say it, the 10 million people stuck in traffic in their cars wouldn't be laughing. It's not funny when you say, good job. It's funny when you say, you're a fucking idiot.
Yeah.
And my dad, to this day, still doesn't understand.
As far as the dynamic of the show, like being around, I don't know what other film or productions you've been around, do you think that Howard, the way he runs things there, stands out as being superior?
Now or then?
In your experience, looking back now at what it was.
Back then, it was like, it was on point, other than the fact that, you know, nobody got paid, but, you know, it was definitely, I didn't get paid for 5 years at all. It wasn't getting credited at school. I could have, like, sued the living shit out of them.
Internship there literally was free work where you were getting nothing anywhere?
Yeah, nothing for at least 5.5 years.
So how are you supporting yourself at that point?
Because I hustle, bro. Shawnee, I hustle. I've always hustled. I'm still hustling right now. Okay, this COVID shit threw my game off. But, you know, I always had a hustle going on. I had bartending gigs. I did appearances. I did whatever I had to do to make my nut, and I always did.
Wow, I didn't know it was 5 years unpaid.
Oh, 5 years unpaid, but apparently there's a statute of limitations, so who knows?
Wow. So then, at what point did it get uncomfortable with this show, and how did you leave off?
That's funny. That's perfect segue, my friend. At some point, Tom Chiasano realized that I was not getting credit at school and how long I've been there and not getting paid, and realized that if this ever got public, it would be his fucking ass, because it's his responsibility. It's his job. He's the general manager. So there was a very frantic meeting that I had with Tom Chiasano in his office where he was physically nervous, stuttering, fidgeting, asking me, when's the last time I got credited at school? And I was like, Tom, I haven't been to school in like 2 years. I was like, and the last time I got credit when I was at school was like 3 years before that. And the blood left, like he became white and he was like twitching and nervous. And he's like, well, you can't be here. You can't be here. I was like, are you firing me from a job that I don't get paid for? And he's like, no, you do it. Like, and he was like, he knew like the repercussions of what would happen if he got busted having someone working for free 60 hours a week and not getting paid. And he was like, you can't be here. You can't be here. I was like, so I'm not supposed to show up tomorrow, Tom? What does this mean? And he's like, I don't know, but you can't be here. And he's like, okay, just go. And he realized how much trouble he could have got into. That's fucking slavery, bro.
It's about 1,000 hours that you worked on
Baby. Yeah. Oh, and more so than you even know, bro. Talking about going out at night with Stuttering John and shit like that. That should be paid. I got beat up by Spike Lee's bodyguard, Joe. It's like fucking, I didn't get nothing for it. And Howard told me not to sue him, and I should have. So I go and walk Howard down, and I'm like, Tom says I can't be here tomorrow. He's like, what? What are you talking about? I was like, well, I haven't been getting credit at school for like 5 years. Tom wants me not to be here. He goes, I'll talk to Tom. So the answer from that was, instead of getting a regular decent salary, I got paid minimum wage, which at that point was probably like $6.35 an hour. And the 60 hours that I was working a week paid for 30, because if they paid me for 40, that meant I was eligible for health insurance. And why would they do that? So I just took it. But once that $6.35 paycheck, whatever it was I was making at the end of the day, if it was maybe 200 and something bucks after taxes, now I had a corporate leash around my neck. Now they're like, aha, well, you have to do this, you have to do that. And basically, I had to sit there and be on a copy machine and photocopy all of Howard's articles that were, any article that ever mentioned his name ever, I had to photocopy 5 different things. One to Howard, one to Gary, one to Laura, his assistant, one to Tom Chiasano, one to Don Buchwald. And don't forget the very special pain in the ass, special archive paper that I had to take out, put it in, because that archive paper didn't yellow. So that all went to an archive. So I had to sit there and every day for 3 or 4 hours, photocopy Howard Stern articles, any article that ever mentioned his name.
What's the purpose that he does that for?
Narcissistic sociopath? I don't know. ego? He wanted everything that he ever did archived.
Okay, I wasn't sure if it was like making sure nothing was negative or...
No. He just wanted every single thing that ever mentioned. If there was a article that was 16 pages long, and at some point at the end of the article, right at the end, and because of Howard Stern, I had to photocopy that article 16 pages, 5 times, with the extra archive paper, just because it mentioned his name on the 16th page in the last paragraph.
Wow.
So that became extremely dulling and annoying and frustrating. But because now they paid me, I had to do it. So when it came up to after a year of doing that, when it was time to like, okay, it's been a year, I sat in Tom Chiasano's office and I said, I've been doing this. I said, look, I'm working 60 hours a week. All I want to get paid is for 40 so I can get health insurance. And can I have like a pretty decent salary that I can live on? And Tom said, no, you'll get the company salary, the standard company salary increase, which is like 4.25%, which meant 60 cents to me. And if you're working 60 hours, then you need to work only 30, which means you have to leave at like 10 o'clock every day. And I went, okay. And then I got in the elevator and I told Howard exactly what I just told you. And the defining moment of my life, when Howard goes, yeah, well, that's Tom. And that very moment is when I decided I am quitting. I was like, yo, you ain't standing up for me, motherfucker. I was like, I better leave now and bow out graciously, because I always want to keep that ace in my back pocket. Because if I stay, you're going to have to fucking fire me. I'm going to wind up coming in here with a shotgun. So I that moment I said, yeah, I'm going to LA to become an actor. See ya. That was that.
Wow. So looking back on it, do you sum up the whole experience as it was a good experience where you learned a lot about yourself?
It was the best experience I've ever had in my entire life. And I didn't realize, with this whole podcast, I didn't realize of the experience that I resonated in who I was until like maybe 10 years ago when Podcasts at Home really first started. And I did, which is one of my best friends in the world, Joe Espermonte. He was a PA with me on Private Parts. He's an assistant director on Blue Bloods now. He's one of my best friends in the world. We started doing a goofy show from his apartment every Friday at the very infancy of podcasting and then doing broadcasting outside of like the FCC guidelines. And we did, and I didn't realize how much I had to say or how easy it was for me to say it. That was 10 years ago. And then I just kept exploring and like doing little things here and there. And I just felt more comfortable doing it. And then, you know, when I had the opportunity at Pro Media where I had the studios, I was just like, yo, let me get behind the mic. And it just started to roll. And I came up with the name Aftershock XL because I figured Howard's become pussified and not the person that he used to be. And that shock era is gone. You know, not that I'm going to fill the shoes, but it's after shock. Like, who's going to, what's the next level? Who's going to be real? Who's going to keep it real? Who's going to pick up the slack? So, and then the Aftershock was taken. So I said, let's take it another level. Let's go XL.
No, it's great. It stands out. And it's a great podcast. The sound quality is really, really, really top notch.
Well, it's going to get better. I'm about to turn my spare bedroom into where I'm talking to you right now, into a podcast studio where I can do the right thing, make it look real. And I'm going to rent it out to people that want to do podcasts and come in here. And, you know, it'll be a sterile room. I have UVC lights that will sterilize the room and the equipment. I'm hoping, you know, I can do this at a bare minimum. And just, I have the people, at the technology, I have the backing. I have someone like Tim Sabian that's got my back, and Doug Goodstein, and all those people. I got Pro Media, Joe and Scott and Max, it's audio engineers, it's lighting people I have that will back me up. And just turn my other room into a little podcast studio.
So you're starting this right now? This is all like in the work?
This is my plan right now, because if this doesn't work, I'm going to be on the street.
When are you planning on having that up and running?
The way I am with my ADD, tomorrow. But it's not going to happen. I got to come up with a business plan. Some people are on vacation. Just getting people on this to come together on the same day is the bane of my existence. People had misinformation about vacation plans, this and that. Hopefully next week, if I can nail down all these people and come up with the proper business plan, get some investors, I would like to have the premiere show on my birthday, September 18th, in my apartment at the new studio.
Well, I think you know all the right people. Now, like you said, just getting them all coordinated and making it happen.
Yeah.
Well, it sounds like you definitely have taken those experiences and now you're running with them. And I've heard great things from everyone that knows you from all the years of when you were on it. And I appreciate you taking time out to let me speak to you. And I wish you nothing but the best. And I will definitely be tuning into your podcast, supporting any way
I can. Whatever I can do to help you out, dude, I'd be more than happy. Like the fact that you reach out to me, it's kind of like there's other podcasters that reach out to me and like we'd be on my show. And I'm like, who the fuck am I not to say yes? Like I'm doing the same thing. A, horrible karma. B, like, you know, it doesn't matter. Who knows? Like if I get like 100 new listeners because I did your show, that's fantastic. Thank you so much for having me on. Seriously. I'll never say no to anybody unless I really just don't like you personally. But you also come highly recommended from some people that I really care about. So there's no way in hell I was going to say no to you. I was just, I apologize for the delay. There's always something going on, you know?
I've got to laugh at you saying that just now because when I was talking to Jackie, and even when we were summing up the interview, and I've talked to him, I can't even count how many times. But as we're doing the interview, we're like summing up, and I'm thanking him, and he says, oh, don't even mention it. I do these things whenever someone asks. Anyone that wants to talk to me, I'm willing to. And I'm like, well, thanks for taking all the wind out of my sail right now.
Yeah, no, but it's not just that. You know, we're all here to help each other, bro. That's the bottom line.
You know, I didn't want to say anything negative about Howard because like the whole idea of my podcast, it's learning from mistakes and learning from what you would have done differently looking back. And I didn't want something negative to just badmouth Howard and say, because I can pretty much look at from a business standpoint and being involved in multiple businesses, I could justify why Howard did some of the things that he did, although it doesn't seem right to the person who's going through it. I mean, I can understand why someone would in business cut their costs, but then to hear the human element of it and hear like what you went through, and he's someone who I idolize and look up to since I was probably 12. So to hear some of these stories, it kind of saddens me because you want to believe that he got to where he did by taking care of people and they helped that as he ascended. But
no, I got a $2,000 check. I got a $2,000 check and don't let the door hit you on the ass. But it doesn't take away how much I love the guy. But could he have done more? Hell yeah. Did he? No.
I respect you for keeping your head high and sticking to your principles of you knew that at a certain point they weren't going to do more for you. And
what the fuck am I doing here? But then I did like, you know, was I lucky enough to go over to The Sopranos and that was even better. So,
yeah. I saw that when I was looking up your podcast. I forgot that you were on Sopranos, but it's kind of like people say it's being in the right place at the right time.
Well, it goes back to being the second director, Michael DeCasper, God rest his soul, was the most wonderful people I've ever worked with in the entertainment business. He was such a kind, gentle soul, and what a wonderful person to have as a boss. And everybody from Private Parts, when we shot that summer, probably 1993, movie crews are like very, what's the word I'm looking for? Family oriented. There's a lot of nepotism. And so they basically go from shoot to shoot to shoot because they all work well together. So everybody hires the same people. So basically the crew of The Sopranos was the crew of Private Parts.
Oh.
So the little thing that maybe you didn't know, 90% of the crew that was on The Sopranos was from Private Parts. Michael DeCasper brought me in. He goes, "You're about the same size as AJ. You want to be his stand-in?" I was like, "Yes." For 3 seasons, I got to be a part of that crew. And then 9/11 happened and things changed. So for a year, nobody shot and I had to get a real job. I became an electrician and burnt that. I didn't burn the bridge, but I you know, once they started shooting and they asked me to come back, I'm like, I got a real job. And I should have just never stuck with the real job. I should have stuck with that and whatever. Can't go back in time, my friend. But it was a wonderful, wonderful, awesome experience no matter what.
It's almost like scaffolding. Like each one of these experiences has prepared you. And who knows, maybe the podcast will take off. This whole business venture will take off.
Who knows? I know. I'm not going to stop. This is it. I'm going to make this happen. That's the bottom line.
I was going to say to you, this could be the final stop. And now it's taking all those experiences because that's what makes each person unique is their experiences. And people do want to hear about what someone went through because you learn from each other's mistakes and advice.
And it's just funny. It's funny because like my numbers always spike when I talk about the Howard Stern Show. And I'm fine with talking about the Howard Stern Show. But my whole goal was not necessarily always to sit here and talk about the Howard Stern Show. But A, you got to be smart and understand where the crowd goes and what you're attracting. But, you know, if you go back and listen to a lot of shit I did, not every show, everyone's like, "Oh, Grillo's talking about the Stern Show again." Fuck you. I have every right to talk about the Stern Show. And I will at my leisure. And you don't like it, don't fucking listen. No offense to you, because it's not at you. But like these people that just like, these haters are like, "Oh, it's about the Stern Show again. Here we go." Yeah. Yeah. I earned my shit. I can talk about that shit whenever I want. And I will. But it's not a crutch. It's not a crutch. I can do this without having to talk about Howard Stern. But if my numbers go up when I do, if I'm in the middle of a conversation, I'll just stop and go, "Howard Stern." And all of a sudden the numbers go up. Well, fuck you. You know what I'm saying?
I agree with you. And the reason I do agree with you, if someone did a movie and all they do is talk about that one movie, then I understand like, oh, here they go talking about it again. But you had an entire career. You had 8 years working on a show. So it's not like one thing. You worked in many different areas of it. You observed a lot about it. Like you were the fly on the wall. People pay, I don't know if you know who Tim Grover is, but he was strength and conditioning coach for Michael Jordan and then Scottie Pippen, and he worked with Dennis Rodman. And he sells a training system and he teaches people the mindset of a champion. And you look at what you pay for it, and he says, "I was the fly on the wall to hear all these champions in the locker room, hearing the strategy, hearing what they talked about. I can help you with your whatever aspect he's coaching people in." And that stood out to me. Like, here's the guy who heard conversations. Like, you are in the room while Howard and he's brainstorming ideas and hearing how he came up with it. So tremendous value in talking to people about that, but maybe even not going almost that route of where you were screwed or where you were treated like that, but almost looking at it in a positive way to say, you know what, here's what I observed. Maybe you start training people who are wanting to get to radio or podcasting. Because like you said, you have such an education in this. If you were to start running a course in podcasting out of that space in the apartment and you're teaching people where to position the mic, how to hold it, there's many people out there that have the talents that you have deep down, but no one is here to help nurture that because they don't have anywhere to do it. So you can now provide a platform to where you could not only have them have a studio to work out of, but you can teach them what you learned working for the greatest radio show of all time. How do you like that biz model?
I appreciate that. No, that you just brought a whole nother aspect to my business plan, my friend.
For more info, visit getconnex.com. That's GETCONNEXX.com. Or visit us on Facebook at Connex, INC, or on Instagram at Connex_. And a special thanks to our sponsor, Don Pablo. Boulder Coffee is roasted in small batches, providing the freshest tasting coffee imaginable. Simply put, it's a better cup of coffee. Order on Amazon or at DonPabloCoffee.com.